Good morning, and welcome to The People's Business, a production of the Fiscal Policy Institute and WRPI's Public Affairs Committee, and a part of WRPI's regular Tuesday morning feature, Capital District Progressive Radio. I'm Frank Morrow, Executive Director Emeritus of the Fiscal Policy Institute, and I'm pleased to be joined in the studio by Ron Deutsch, Executive Director of New Yorkers for Fiscal Fairness, as we try our best to cast a little sunshine on the ways in which government is doing and not doing the people's business. We're also usually joined by Brian McDonnell, who's the Legislative and Political Director for AFSCME New York. That's the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. But Brian is out of town in Chicago for the annual convention of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. But we expect he'll be back with us in August. In today's program, we're going to be speaking with Fordham Law School professor and gubernatorial candidate Zephyr Teachout. You may remember from the news that she made a bid for the Working Families Party nomination for governor, but was edged out at the convention by Governor Andrew Cuomo, who sought the Working Families Party endorsement as a extra line. But now she has filed a significant number of petitions to be in the Democratic primary for governor. So we'll find out what her platform is for governor and what she thinks she can accomplish as governor. But before we hear from Professor Teachout, we're pleased to be joined on the telephone by State Senator Liz Krueger. Senator Krueger, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good.
Good.
Well, good morning, Senator Krueger. This is Ron Deutsch. I also want to welcome you here to the People's Business on WRPI in Troy.
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you.
We're glad you're with us. So you're a resident of the east side of Manhattan, and you're currently the ranking member of the Senate Finance Committee and a member of various other Senate committees like the Elections Committee, Higher Ed, Mental Health, and that all-important one, Rules.
Yes, indeed. Codes.
And codes. Oh, I forgot that one. Sorry.
It's okay.
You were first elected to the Senate back in a special election, I believe, in 2002, and you're in your 13th year in the Senate now, which seems hard to believe.
To me also.
Time flies when you're having fun, I guess, right?
That's what we call it. Yes, Ron, fine.
Does it seem that long to you, 13 years?
You know, some days it feels like it just happened, and some days it feels like, oh, I've been going back and forth to Albany for a long time. But what hasn't changed is my passion for trying to get us the best government we can on behalf of the state of New York.
Well, you're certainly doing an admirable job in that regard, so we appreciate that. But I wanted to ask you, in terms of your work in the state Senate, what does it mean, actually? You know, you're a Democrat, but you're a ranking member of the Senate Finance Committee. So what are some of the issues and decisions that you've gotten involved with as a result of being a ranking member of this committee?
Well, you've known me a long time, Ron, so you know that I actually spent 20 years of my life running not-for-profit organizations working on issues for low-income New Yorkers and trying to help expand access to adequate wages, government assistance, and good jobs. I then ended up being drafted, I have to admit, against my will to run for office because people were saying the things you want done and we want done aren't happening because of conservative Republicans controlling the Senate. So people like you have to go on in and change it from inside. So, in fact, that's what I did. It was a complicated story, 4 elections in a 5-year period, but then I was there. I realized quickly everything in state policy, every law has a connection to budget and monetary issues. So I decided I needed to master the numbers and the money and committed myself to my goal of getting as high up as I could in the Finance Committee, with my ultimate goal being the first liberal woman chair of the Senate Finance Committee and trying to have an impact on a broad range of government policy issues from that position. And that's exactly what I have been trying to accomplish now, again, starting my 13th year.
We're speaking with State Senator Liz Krueger, whose current district covers most but not absolutely all of the east side of Manhattan, from 96th Street on the north to East 10th Street on the south. And she also covers a small number of blocks west of Fifth Avenue, including all of Central Park South.
So, very good. Yes.
So overall, this is one of the highest income state legislative districts in the country and home to many of the nation's most prominent firms and cultural institutions. What are the special challenges and opportunities that come with representing such an area?
Well, you're exactly right. Sometimes it seems an irony to people that my passion is to try to make government more responsive for the poorest New Yorkers, when in fact I technically represent the richest New Yorkers. Now, I am totally comfortable with this, and happily for me, the voters of my district have seemed to be perfectly happy with this. I continually talk about tax policy and why people who are doing well, people who are successful, can afford to pay the taxes we need to meet the needs of those who need some help from government. And I constantly talk about why what happens for middle class and working class and poor New Yorkers has a direct relationship to those in my district who are happily for themselves in a much more financially comfortable position. Now, it's not true that everyone in my district is rich. In fact, I have a disproportionately large number of senior citizens in my district who have lived here their whole lives and who have now aged into a place where they may, in fact, have very limited income available to meet their basic needs and no ability to increase their income. So I have this really interesting mix of people towards the end of their lives facing financial pressures, but lots and lots of people who are extremely above whatever the average or the norm would for New York State. I very proudly talk about myself as a liberal Democrat who understands the importance of government representing everyone's needs in order to protect this very delicate concept of democracy that we are trying to hold on to.
Yeah, and you really, I mean, it's interesting that, you know, you have this district where you have this incredible wealth, and you've been one of the most outspoken advocates for, you know, higher rates of income tax for the wealthiest here in New York. Certainly, you know, you supported the millionaires tax as the so-called millionaires tax, and then fought to also maintain it when the governor was looking to let it lapse. And then he had an epiphany, and we actually did keep part of it, at least. But do you think there's room at the top end of the income spectrum? Do you think people are overtaxed at that end, or do you think there's still room for a more progressive tax structure than we currently have in New York, and how might you go about changing that?
Great. I think there is room for a more progressive tax structure, and I think it's important to talk about it in those terms because, look, we're Americans. Everybody thinks their taxes are too high. For some reason, it's sort of a genetic pattern with us. But it's actually not statistically true for quite a few people. And people get themselves trapped in, well, my tax rate is X. And they don't stop and realize that because of all the exemptions and deductions and credits that they're eligible for, the businesses they work or run are eligible for, that in fact the actual tax rate they're paying is far, far lower than the quote-unquote stated number. And that is a fundamental challenge for our state that I am very excited to be able to continue to push and change. We spend a minimum of $7 billion a year of state money on business tax deductions and exemptions and credits that nobody can actually justify as having a societal good, expanding the number of jobs, improving the level or the wages. They just are there because of special interests sliding them into the tax code and nobody ever opening them up and saying, why do we have these? Imagine if we had $7 billion more per year in the state budget without raising anyone's tax rates to provide the kinds of fundamental things that every single year people come to me and testify in the budget hearings and show up in my offices and have me go visit programs that are unbelievably successful but desperately underfunded. $7 billion without talking about actually raising taxes. There's a lot of work we can do and enormous accomplishments that we could have.
Right, and that's $7 billion a year.
Yes.
So the proportion is interesting because there's a current issue, which is we have a one-time so-called windfall of about half that amount because of a legal settlement with a French financial institution, Paribas PNP. Have you thought about how New York should use the $3-plus billion it's getting from this settlement?
Well, it's an interesting question because I actually had my finance staff look into this and how it will be structured to come to the state of New York. So it doesn't look like, at least according to OMB, that we're going to, Department of Budget, excuse me, state versus city, that we're going to be seeing the money immediately. But you're absolutely right. Within a year, we'll be seeing the upward of $3.5 billion, and some money comes to the criminal justice people who were involved on top of that. When you look at that one-time lump sum, which is enormous, there's a lot of things you can think about that you wish you could spend that on. But my gut, and you'll tell me if I'm wrong, Frank, and I've listened to you for a long, long time, is that you should be doing infrastructure capital expenditures with one-time surprise money.
Right. Yeah.
Right?
Yes. And you shouldn't be using it for recurring expenses.
Right, because it's not an ongoing funding stream. But $3.5 billion, I think we all agree, is a lot of money that you could be investing in major capital assignments that you have as a state without having to go and borrow additional money at very high interest rates.
Right. Do you think any should go into an endowment or a trust fund or a rainy day fund? Those are all slightly different things. But,
right. I love the concept of a housing trust fund that we've had hypothetically without any money in it for a long time. Now, as you know, one of my passions is affordable housing, and so the concept that you would have a significant chunk of money in an actual housing trust fund that could then be used specifically to support the capital costs of expanding affordable housing, you wouldn't get a lot of argument from me if you came to me with a proposal like that.
Yeah, I think there's no question, too. I mean, if you look at upstate's cities, there's an ailing infrastructure that's in place right now. And, you know, the governor talks a lot about trying to rejuvenate upstate New York. But, you know, if we don't do a better job at making sure that the infrastructure is solid, you know, why would businesses want to locate there anyway, regardless of programs like Startup New York or other potential gimmicks?
And the low cost of living.
And right.
Compared to downstate and other metropolitan areas like New York City. A lot of the most vibrant metropolitan areas are high cost of living places, New York, Boston, San Francisco. So I think that upstate hasn't thrived because it's a low cost of living place. So there are obviously other things we need to do. And I think making sure that the infrastructure is sound is important.
And you know, gentlemen, when you read the research of businesses and what they say are their decision-making factors when they're choosing to start up somewhere or move somewhere, the local taxes are a very low number on their scale. But the infrastructure support for themselves and a qualified workforce are up at the top.
Right.
So I do believe that upstate New York would absolutely benefit from stronger infrastructure and the qualified workforce that is needed by companies in the 21st century who are interested or could be made interested in coming to our state or expanding what they're doing in our state. I think that's a win-win for everyone.
Yeah, you're right, and I think Mayor Bloomberg has agreed with you in the past as well. I mean, I think he's one of the people who's always said, you know, if you're basing your business decision where to locate on the tax rates, then you've got a pretty poor business model.
Exactly.
But let's shift gears here to talk about what I like to call the Klein Kumbaya. And it seems like there is a reunification effort underway here. Senator Klein, the leader of the IDC, the Independent Democratic Conference, in the New York State Senate, is moving his allegiance, it seems, from the Republican quote-unquote majority to going back to the Democratic fold. I was wondering maybe you could enlighten us a little bit about what's going on here, how this power sharing structure may work, and how things are moving along in that regard.
Well, it's pretty much as the press has been describing now for several weeks. The IDC is not rejoining the Democrats, but they say that in the new session, they will caucus with the Democrats rather than the Republicans, which is what they did in 13 and 14. And what's so important for your listeners to understand is whoever is defined as the majority numerically, and these four and then five and then four and then five IDC members gave the Republican minority the numbers to be the majority. That majority then controls the agenda of what bills come to the floor of the Senate. That's the fundamental issue. It's not whether you've got the votes on any specific bill, but whether you can actually get bills to the floor for votes. So the fact that the IDC has said that they will caucus and join with the Democrats in the new fiscal year, the new session year, means that there, in fact, can be technically a Democratic majority determining the agenda of what bills come to the floor and get voted on. Now, lots of details have not been worked out, and they probably won't be until after the election cycle, because technically the rules of the Senate have to be voted on by the incoming senators, and none of that will even technically be known until after the November elections. Then we will see who are the actual senators going into 2014, and only that universe of people, and I'm hoping to be one of them after my elections, will be the ones who determine what the rules of the Senate will be for the 15-16 session.
We're speaking with Senator Liz Krueger, who's the ranking member of the State Senate's Finance Committee, and one of the leading floor speakers in the Senate as the Senate debates issues. And we're talking about the recent announcement by the leadership of the Senate Democratic Conference and the Senate's Independent Democratic Conference, and Governor Cuomo and New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio for a planned reunification of a type that Senator Krueger was just describing. So we're talking about that. Senator Krueger, you mentioned that currently and in the past session, the Independent Democratic Conference, this group of four or five or four so-called breakaway Democrats, caucused with the Republicans. Did they actually caucus jointly, or did they have separate caucuses and their leaders share with each other what the two caucuses wanted to do, or was there actually a caucus in which the Independent Democrats and the Republicans talked together?
Oh, that's an excellent question. I actually don't know whether they all met as one group sometimes or whether they always met as two groups with the two leaders, Dean Skelos and Jeff Klein, then talking to each other. Great question. I don't technically know the answer. But you're right that this change of position by the IDC was heavily influenced by encouragement / pressure by the mayor, the governor, people of the state of New York saying, what are you doing? You run as Democrats, and then you give the power to control what the Senate does to the Republicans. You know, can you really keep justifying this? And I hope, and I'm crossing my fingers, that the answer is no. They can't keep justifying this, and they won't reverse and decide to go back to the Republicans. But we won't know until after, you know, until the new year.
I guess I'm wondering, you know, I guess thinking toward the future, if this actually does occur, all the stars align, everything falls into place. I mean, do you see the kind of, even, you know, as you pointed out, the IDC will remain kind of independent of the Senate Democratic Conference. Do you see this kind of power-sharing agreement similar to what was developed by Senator Klein and Senator Skelos, where, let's say, Senator Klein and Senator Stuart Cousins have to agree on what comes to the floor? Any ideas on how this might work? I know we've read a little bit about it in the press, but I'm wondering if you might be able to offer any insight or have any ideas or maybe even suggestions on how that might work.
I don't know exactly how it's going to play out. I don't know that anybody does. I would prefer one Democratic conference. That would be my preference, but I get the sense that is not the case. We don't know, again, the numbers. I'm feeling very optimistic about having more Democrats in seats throughout the state after November than we had in the last cycle, which also changes the phenomena. For the record, I've endorsed both John Liu and Oliver Capel in their primaries against two of the IDC members, because I think that the two gentlemen I named, Oliver Capel and John Liu, are stronger Democrats to take those seats on behalf of those communities. I don't know whether they will be successful or not. And so there can be shifting winds in who are the Republicans coming back, how many new Democrats are coming back, and even the size of the IDC conference compared to where it was. Lots of this is still in the hands of the electorate and what happens in the election cycle. And of course, you know, we woke up yesterday and learned that one of the senior Republican senators that I never imagined wasn't running again has decided not to run again, from Western New York, George Maziarz. You know, there's rumors flying. There's more people who may suddenly announce they're not running. So we're living in a state with shifting sands when it comes to the Senate election process this year.
Yeah, it does seem, I mean, I was floored by the announcement that Senator Maziarz wouldn't be running for re-election. I think that was a bit of a surprise to everybody. And,
yes,
you know, there's a lot of speculation about why. And, you know, obviously he will say, you know, he's had enough. 20 years or so in the Senate is enough. And I'm sure you might be able to agree with him on that, too, that, you know, it is a frustrating position at times, and it requires lots of travel and a great deal of commitment. But, you know, he's also been looked at by the Moreland Commission, or was being looked at by the Moreland Commission for questionable campaign uses of his campaign fund. But, you know, then you have Senator Libous with his own unique set of problems.
Exactly.
And then, as you pointed out, too, there was some speculation, although some of the senators are putting that to rest, like Senator Bonasek, supposedly he was going to leave, but he's saying that's absolutely not true. Then there was recent speculation about Senator Gallivan. You know, what do you make of that? It seems like, you know, some of these Republican senators are deciding to call it quits. Do you think they see the writing on the wall, as it were, or what do you think's going on here?
You know what, I think it's exactly that last sentence. I think that current elected officials and people all over the state are recognizing that the Democrats are taking the majority in the Senate, and that the mistakes that we made in 9-10, where we barely took the majority and then everything started to fall apart rapidly soon after, that that's not going to repeat itself, and that the Democrats can, in fact, take a significant majority this cycle that will not be reversed for quite a while. And so for some senators who, frankly, don't love the idea of shifting to the minority, this might be exactly the right time for them to say, I've had enough. Other senators, and I have no inside information until I read the papers like all of us, may in fact be in trouble with the criminal justice system, as was implied in the newspaper stories about Senator Maziarz, because several of his, I guess, key aides were subpoenaed.
Right. You mentioned that Senator George Maziarz represents Niagara, Orleans, and a little bit of Monroe County. He's a former county clerk of Niagara County, and he's been a guest here on the People's Business on several occasions, and always been a very frank and open spokesman for what I would say sort of the unique brand of Republicanism that he represents. He isn't necessarily always on the same wavelength as his leaders. So we wish him the best of luck. We're speaking with Senator Liz Krueger. Let's turn back to the Senate Finance Committee work you do. In the coming months, we're going to have a couple of rebate check in the mail moments. $350 family rebate checks for people who 2 years ago filed returns with children, and then another set of rebate checks for homeowners whose school districts live within the property tax cap. When are these rebate checks concepts going to hit? And what do you think of this idea of using the tax system for targeted rebate checks?
Well, for the record, I am not a fan and did not really support either of these proposals. I would prefer a model, again, of fair and progressive taxation where we take the taxes we need from people and we don't get into the games of then selecting some subsets of people to give money back to, particularly in a rebate model right before an election. Certainly, there are many who have said, and perhaps the two of you, that this smells a little bit like, hi, I'm your elected official, I'm giving you free money right before I'm asking you to vote for me. I'm actually very uncomfortable with the model of doing such. Now, it may be true that there is a real need to address inequities in taxation when it comes to property taxes for certain people in certain communities. I actually, and Ron knows this because we have spent a lot of time working on this issue together, I think our entire model of property taxation is antiquated and not working in the state of New York, and we should be revisiting and redesigning the whole system. But I don't think selecting some subset who may not even be the people who really need the help to hand out rebate checks, or in this case, you're right, two sets of rebate checks right before elections, is good tax policy or good government. And it does come right up against that line of, wow, we have the wild, wild west of campaign finance reform in New York State because we can even mail out checks to you right before election. And we even joke about, you know, how do you scribble your name on the envelope or the side of the check so they think you gave it to them?
Right.
Yeah. I got one more question for you. I know I could talk to you all day, but we're reaching the end of our half hour here. But one of the big criticisms that we're hearing from Republicans right now is that, you know, the Senate Dems would, as they would say, forget about upstate New York. Is that true? Do you think that that would happen? That seems to be their big mantra right now for the reason why the Democrats should not control the Senate is because upstate New York will be devastated. So what do you make of that claim?
You know, I think it's crap with all due respect to whoever's saying that.
Don't sugarcoat it,
Senator. Why wouldn't the Democratic Party care about the entire state of New York? First off, all of our growth in the party is coming out of not New York City. All of us in New York City, and I'm proud that I'm a New York City resident and representative, understand that New York City ends up having to subsidize through our taxes the rest of the state because we haven't all been working together to make sure that there's economic opportunity throughout the state of New York. It is a win-win for those of us in New York City when the rest of the state is stronger and is doing well. That's not even partisan. That's simply a fact. Democrats want to take the majority and hold the majority, which means our growth is dependent on being able to continue to deliver and expand our vision with the rest of the state. And so I always find it so interesting that it's sort of like we're the boogeyman in a horror movie. If the Democrats from New York City have control, you know, horror movie scenes are going to happen at night. Well, we're not scary, and we're not horror movie people, and we actually want what's best for all 19.5 million people. So I actually think when Republicans, to be partisan for a minute, start to rail like this, it's because they've got no real arguments to make. They're just trying to say they're scary down there. Come on down to New York City. We are so not scary. It's fabulous. It's fun. We're very friendly and warm. And in fact, the Democratic Party has better answers for upstate New York than the Republicans have. And hello, they've been in control basically for 100 years. Have their proposals been working? I don't think so.
Okay. Senator Krueger, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is The People's Business on WRPI Troy, and we've been speaking with State Senator Liz Krueger, the ranking member of the Senate Finance Committee and one of the leading speakers for the Democratic Conference in Senate floor debates on a wide range of issues. Senator Krueger, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us this morning.
Thank you for having me on, gentlemen. Take care.
It was a pleasure.
If you'd like to learn more about Senator Krueger's work and her issues, her website is Liz Krueger, Krueger with an E, K-R-U-E-G-E-R. So it's Liz Krueger without any spaces .com. We are now pleased to be joined on the telephone by Fordham Law School professor and gubernatorial candidate Zephyr Teachout. As we understand it from her website, which is zephyrteachout.com, Professor Teachout teaches constitutional law and property law at Fordham Law School. She has made the decision to run for governor, and we're going to find out a little more about why she's running for governor, what she wants to accomplish, and why she would be a good governor. Professor Teachout, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us this morning.
Oh, I'm thrilled to be on. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for coming on the show with us today.
No, I'm delighted to talk. It's now been, 3 days since we, or 4 days since we submitted over 46,000 petitions to get on the ballot for the Democratic primary. And so our focus for the next 2 months is getting out and talking to as many people as possible. I'm running with Tim Wu. He's my lieutenant governor candidate. And we are challenging Governor Andrew Cuomo and his lieutenant governor pick, Kathy Hochul.
Yay.
How did you decide to run for governor, of all things?
Well, look, New York is a Democratic state that has traditionally been a leader in supporting education, been a leader in investing in infrastructure, has a deep commitment to equality and fairness. And look, I supported Governor Cuomo 4 years ago, but the last 4 years, we've basically had something closer to a Republican governor than a Democratic governor. He's pursued trickle-down economic policies. He starved our schools. And I think that New York State can be doing so much better than this. So I felt like it was necessary to challenge Governor Cuomo.
Well, you've certainly done that. I mean, submitting 45,000 petitions, you've submitted three times more than the needed amount. I am sure that you were potentially anticipating a challenge to those petitions. What are you doing to thwart that potential challenge? And do you even think that the governor will challenge you?
It's a great question. Just so your listeners understand, you need to have 15,000 petitions to get on the ballot in New York. And there's particular rules about where you need to get the petition signatures from. And we anticipate that Governor Cuomo will probably mount a legal challenge. We've heard he's actively considering it because he'd rather have a fight at the ballot than a fight about what's happening with school funding and why he won't answer questions about fracking. Although we have heard rumors in recent days that he may not want to challenge because it's pretty clear we're going to stay on the ballot. So you know, I've worked on, I'm a law professor, but I've worked on political campaigns for many, many years, and at all different levels of government. And we are completely ready for any legal challenge that he comes our way, he brings our way.
Speaking of having worked on political campaigns at various levels, our guest Zephyr Teachout was active in Howard Dean's 2004 presidential campaign. Before we ask you about why you decided to go from working on campaigns to being a candidate yourself, tell us how you got involved in Howard Dean's 2004 presidential campaign and how and why, as a lawyer, you became the director of online organizing for that campaign rather than having a role that might be more stereotypically that of a lawyer policy wonk.
Great. Yeah, I love politics. I really do. And you know, I think of politics as being when people come together and say, what should we do? Should we build a bridge or should we add another firefighter? So my natural attraction is towards situations in which I can help bring people together, listen to them, and help express their views. So when I got involved in Governor Dean's campaign in 2003, I naturally gravitated towards, you know, what we call in campaigns organizing work. And I was initially responsible for 17 states. Now, you try to organize 17 states with a couple thousand dollars, and you quickly learn you need to use the internet to do it and really empower people to do their own organizing. And that's something we're bringing to the Teach Out Woo campaign as well. We are setting up structures where wherever you are in the state, instead of telling you exactly what to do, we're going to give you some guidance. But if you want to support the Teach Out Woo campaign, we'll give you guidance on things to do, but really encourage you to win your own town, win your street, or if you're particularly involved in an issue, you know, win your community of fractivists. Because that's where you, that's what enables people power to take on the money power. Governor Cuomo has well over $30 million. And if this campaign ends up just being about who can advertise more, you know, that's an uphill battle for us. But if this campaign ends up being about what the people of New York really want, and the Democrats of New York really want, and people across the state get involved and truly take back their politics by themselves organizing, we can win this thing.
Yeah, you do. I mean, there's no question about it. I mean, you have an uphill battle in terms of money, certainly. I mean, the governor, as you point out, has, you know, probably well over $33 million at this point right now that he's, you know, raised largely from very big, wealthy corporate interests.
Yeah.
Have been certainly the biggest donors to his campaign and filled his campaign coffers. You know, it seems like, you know, that makes you a bit beholden to some of these big corporate interests as well. You know, not that from my perspective, the governor's been creating tax policy that favors corporations over people. Far be it from me to say things like that, but
well, it has real world impacts. I mean,
it really does.
It's just think about it in common sense terms. If you are spending your time talking to people who can write $60,000 checks for your campaign, $60,000. I mean, these are outrageous amounts of money that are coming in campaign contributions. Those people don't worry about dental care. They're not worried about their kids being in an overcrowded school. You know, they're not worried about infrastructure. Right. And if he is spending his time around people who have an extra $60,000, it helps explain how, and I really think it's a tragedy what's happened in the last 4 years. You know, how in a state that absolutely supports public education, we have incredible overcrowding, some of the most segregated schools in the country, and we're not actually doing the work we need to do to support our kids.
Did you attend public schools?
Yeah, no, I went to public school both for elementary school and high school. And then actually my first job out of college, I went to Yale. And my first job out of college was as a special education teacher's aide in a small rural public school in Vermont where I grew up. And that of course really influences how I think about this, because I think about the kids that I worked with, some of whom had, you know, real emotional difficulties because of troubles at home. And right now, I was in a pretty small classroom, and there were still challenges. I was in a teacher's aide in a small classroom. But I think, okay, what if I were with those same kids and that teacher had an overcrowded classroom, no extra teacher's aide, and was forced to do, Common Core testing that the teacher hadn't been involved in developing. And then the teacher themselves, as under the current system, was being measured on how well the kids did on that testing. That kind of level of stress and fear is not conducive to learning and certainly would not allow the kids that I worked with to flourish. I think we have to really, when we're thinking about school funding, these aren't numbers on a line. This is our future and our present. And schools are very delicate things that we need to nurture. We need to trust teachers. We need to give them the resources they need.
Yeah, it seems like there's quite a few demoralized teachers out there right now, given the current climate around education and the certainly the way the governor's been talking about it over the last few years. But let me ask you this. I mean, certainly education is a huge issue. To me, it also speaks to the issues of inequality and fairness as well, something that you've made kind of the centerpiece of your campaign. Do you agree with that?
Yeah. I mean, right now, there's some research that suggests that New York State leads the country in income inequality.
Well, I think that's empirically correct.
Yes. But just think about that. Think about this in terms of, Lady Liberty and our complete commitment to bringing people in and providing a fair playing field. And we have, child poverty rates that are at really outrageous levels at the same time as the incomes of the 1% have risen. This is not a state of nature. This is a result of choices that we have made as a state. And in the wake of the crisis of 2008, Tim and I sometimes think of ourselves as post-crash politicians. That crisis laid bare the inequality at the root of our society and was a real, real call to action that we need to do something about the way our economy and democracy is structured. But instead of addressing it, what Governor Cuomo has really focused on is reduction in the estate tax, corporate tax breaks, and a bank tax system, which is really unfair and doesn't require banks to share their part of the burden. So we don't have to have the unequal New York that we have. We can have an equal and fair New York. And as you said, it's a core of my campaign because I know that most New Yorkers are with me on this. Everybody hurts. We want an economy and democracy that works for all of us, not just the wealthy and well-connected. And all of us want that. Talk to business owners. For the most part, they don't want this kind of unequal New York. We know things are out of whack.
This is the People's Business on WRPI Troy, and we're speaking with Fordham Law School professor Zephyr Teachout, who is a candidate for governor in the Democratic primary. The primary is in September. Is it September 9th?
That's right, September 9th.
Okay.
So we've got two months to get out there. If you're listening to the show and you're interested, please go to ZephyrTeachout.com or follow me on @ZephyrTeachout on Twitter.
Professor Teachout, you mentioned a minute or two ago, you made reference to your running mate, Tim Wu. He's also a law professor. Tell us about him and how you ended up as running mates in this effort.
Well, so Tim Wu teaches at Columbia Law School. He's the inventor of the term net neutrality, if your listeners have heard about that, which is the idea that the internet should be open to all, basically. And he and I share, we've known each other for several years, and we share a similar vision of the kind of society we want. We've just been talking about the kind of society we don't want, this unequal society. But we have a vision of a society made up of good-paying jobs, truly true investment in infrastructure, and then also opportunity for a lot of small businesses and family farms, and we want to be able to support those. He calls us old-fashioned trust busters because we want to take on the concentrated power that is private power that is taking over government. But the thing I'd like your listeners to focus on is the difference between my running mate, Tim Wu, and Governor Cuomo's running mate, Kathy Hochul. Kathy Hochul was a choice of Governor Cuomo. It's an important choice when you pick your running mate. It says a lot about your values. She's a bank lobbyist, but more importantly, in 2011, when she was running for office, she had a choice of what she wanted to run on. And she chose to run, leading her campaign ads, saying, "I led the fight against illegal immigrants getting driver's licenses." These are campaign ads that are based on fear that these other folks are going to take your job, they're going to take over your way of life. And there's no excuse for running like that in New York State. This is a state that prides itself on being open to immigrants, being really welcoming of first and second generation Americans. Tim is actually the son of two immigrants, and a core part of both of our platforms is figuring out every way in which we can be really welcoming and continue to take advantage of and celebrate immigrant culture in New York.
So let me ask you this. I mean, certainly, you know, you have a populist message that you're trying to get out there. Seems to be resonating with a lot of Democrats and, you know, I think independents as well. Do you see any debates on the horizon? Have you challenged the governor to a debate? Do you think he would ever engage in a debate with you? Where do you see this going?
We are already having a debate. We're having a debate with an empty chair right now, but we're having a debate. And I'll tell you, the power of this campaign is already showing itself. I went to been to a couple endorsement meetings, and Governor Cuomo doesn't show up himself to the Democratic Club, but he sends representative. And so we have had, just 5 nights ago, there were the Village Independent Democrats Club had a debate about which New York they wanted. Do they want Governor Cuomo's New York, or did they want to teach out Wu New York? And they ended up endorsing us. And they had that in the context of a representative of Governor Cuomo and myself talking about our different values. So I would absolutely welcome the chance to debate Governor Cuomo. I'd like to debate him on a series of particular issues. I'll be talking more about my vision for debates in the coming weeks. But I'll tell you, the debate's already happening. And our job is to invite as many people as possible to that debate, because the more people come to that debate, the more people are going to end up supporting our campaign.
You mentioned your appearance before the Village Independent Democrats and Governor Cuomo having a representative there. Who was his representative?
I actually had to leave before the representative spoke because I had to submit my petitions. That was the night that we were mailing them in at 8 o'clock at night from the 34th Street Post Office in New York. So I actually wasn't around for that part of the debate, but I hear it was a lively discussion.
Well, let's move. Let's say fast forward. You win the primary, you win the gubernatorial election, and we have Governor Teachout. What changes on day one with Governor Teachout that we can look forward to?
Look, I think the key job of a governor is to lay out a very clear vision, identify the best people to implement that vision, trust them and work with them, and lead. So I would operate on the most basic level in a very different way than Governor Cuomo. But our first step would be to do everything we could to fight to fully fund public education. That's our present and our future. Right now we aren't even funding at constitutional levels.
Right.
Second step would be to be very clear that we have to ban fracking and move forward on building towards renewables. There's a bunch of minor bills that are already sitting on the table right now that would allow us to move towards that, allowing people to share their energy into the grid. We have a very positive vision of where we can go in terms of clean and renewable energy in the future in New York. And in the background of all of this, the reason, we all know that the reason that New York government isn't representing New York people is because the system is broken and our campaign funding system is broken. So one of the very first steps would be to push through a system which would allow a a bus driver, a secretary to run for office, and not only allow those who have lots of wealthy friends to run for office, to allow people to run for office who have good ideas, not just really big checkbooks. So we'd pass a system of public funding of elections, and the support is there in the state. So we know we can do that.
Would you go further than the current proposal, the Fair Elections proposal that has a 6-to-1 public match with certain limitations? Would you want to go to full public funding of elections in New York?
I'm experienced enough in politics that I know that you sometimes have to make compromises to make big steps.
Right.
And so what I would do is I would focus for the beginning of our term, focus on pushing through the proposal that we already have a broad degree of consensus on. We just need to flip a few more people. And then I would look forward to other to broader systems. But I want to be very practical about what's possible. And there are extraordinary things that are possible right now. We can pass the DREAM Act right now. We can pass the Women's Equality Act right now. We can pass public funding of elections right now. These are all things that we know where the people of New York are. And with a strong governor and a strong vision, we can get them passed. And then, having laid that baseline, we can move towards an even more equal future.
Right. One of the interesting things, I think, some of the political dynamics at play right now, we were just talking to Senator Krueger in the first half hour of the show.
Yeah.
About, you know, Senator Klein coming back into the Democratic fold, as it were. The Republicans in the state Senate seem to be saying that, you know, if there's a Senate Democratic majority, you know, you can basically forget about upstate New York. These folks are only care about New York City. They don't care about upstate New York. What do you have to say about something like that?
Well, I care a great deal about upstate New York. I think we have one New York, and I think both upstate and downstate lose if we see them as these two separate pieces instead of as one unified whole that's feeding each the other. So I will tell you that public education, the schools are really suffering upstate. I'm spending a lot of time talking to teachers upstate and about their own struggles with the lack of funding. I can also tell you that infrastructure is a problem across the state. And the particular infrastructure that we're going to invest in may differ from area to area. But that's something where we, you know, right away, we need to move away from basically tax breaks for big banks, which we know aren't going anywhere. You know, there's a lie that we have to give them tax breaks to stick around.
You don't think they'll all move away?
No. You know, New Jersey at one point tried to lure some traders to New Jersey with the tax breaks for a big Goldman Sachs building. The traders are still in New York. So I have a lot more faith that this state has the resources, upstate, downstate, throughout, and the talent, the natural resources that will continue to draw people from all over the world to come to it. And there's at a most fundamental level, what I hear in both Governor Cuomo and the Republican candidate, who I sometimes call the other Republican candidate, Astorino's language, is they don't have that faith. They're scared. They're scared that the few rich oligarchs are going to leave, and we've got to spend our political energies trying to beg them to stay. And I just see this extraordinary, rich, abundant state that if we have the right laws, we can continue to thrive.
Right. It sounds like, you know, I agree with you, this kind of line that everybody takes whenever they talk about a tax cut. It's like, we need this tax cut or else, you know, this particular segment or this particular population will move out of New York. It's like, you know, it's like if we don't do it, you know, we're just crushing ourselves. So, but it seems like, you know, the governor's been kind of effective in selling that message. You know, he's got this bully pulpit. He's up on his soapbox all the time talking about things. I mean, he talked about the estate tax and cutting, you know, taxes for millionaires and billionaires and decided to call it the move to die tax, you know, as if there's some sort of evidence out there that people are, you know, moving out of New York State to pass away when, you know, in fact, you know, the governor's own tax and finance department would probably refute that claim.
There's very little evidence that this works.
Right.
But, you know, in some ways he uses a bully pulpit. When you have an image of a bully pulpit, you have an image of somebody out among the people of the state talking, exhorting them. But in fact, he actually doesn't engage with reporters or crowds very often.
Right.
And I think, you know, one thing that everybody should demand, a sort of a core ethical demand of being a representative, is that kind of active engagement. Look, we're all going to, you know, say an imperfect word now or then if we're talking on the radio or being open and engaging with crowds. But I think that there's something troubling about hiding behind a wall and not getting out there, not engaging, not going on New York One after several years of being governor.
Right.
Being in very controlled circumstances. And what I think that speaks to is, you know, perhaps at some level he knows that the story he's telling about New York isn't the right story. That only in canned ads can it work, but not when you actually get out there and start mixing it up and talking about what's really happening.
Right. He doesn't seem to like to be challenged on any of his assertions when he makes many of these claims,
he likes to present the position of great power, but hiding from these kinds of challenges actually reflects a certain kind of weakness.
Yeah.
We're speaking with Professor Zephyr Teachout, who's a candidate for the Democratic nomination for governor of New York State in the primary on September 9th. Her website is zephyrteachout.com. It has biographical information about Professor Teachout and her running mate, Professor Tim Wu. Professor Teachout teaches constitutional and property law at Fordham University. What are your plans for balancing running a campaign and your teaching obligations?
My Fordham has been very kind. I'm not independently wealthy, so I can't quit my job. But Fordham has been very kind. I will just be teaching one property law class this fall. I taught it several times before. So in my property law class, we talk a lot about the mortgage crisis and empty homes, and there's a significant overlap between, you know, what people are experiencing right now, which is wherever you are in the state, they're experiencing that the costs are too high. And in the city, it may be that the rent is too high. The rent is too high to live. It's too much of your budget. If you're a small business owner, you can't start a business in the city anymore.
You're not thinking of forming an alliance with Jimmy McMillan in this campaign, are you?
Well, there's a reason he resonated. You know, people like to sort of make a joke out of it, but there's a reason he resonated, which is people are right to say the rent is too high. And again, the rent is too high not because of some organic truth or some natural state of affairs, but because of too much political power of a handful of people who like keeping the rent high and in a way that does not serve the general public. And upstate, it's property taxes. People are really suffering because the state isn't paying its fair share. And they're having to shoulder too much of a burden. Now, Governor Cuomo's response is to cap the amount of property taxes, but the right response is to say no. The state should carry its fair share, and we should look at the deep structural reasons why the tax system, as a whole, looking at income and property and sales all together, why the tax system as a whole currently is actually better for the 1% than for middle-class New Yorkers.
You make an excellent point on property taxes. The governor likes to claim that the reason New York has high property taxes is because it has a lot of local governments. But it's had a lot of local governments for a long time, and that hasn't changed.
Yeah.
You've pinpointed what the big change is the state is contributing a smaller portion of the cost of schools.
Right. Yeah.
And that's putting pressure on the property tax. Well, we thank you very much. We've been speaking to Professor Zephyr Teachout, who teaches at Fordham Law School, and she's running for governor. And we thank you very much, Professor Teachout, for joining us this morning.
It's such a pleasure to be on the show.
Best of luck on the campaign.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
This is The People's Business on WRPI Troy. This is a production of the Fiscal Policy Institute and WRPI's Public Affairs Committee. And we're part of WRPI's regular Tuesday morning feature, Capital District Progressive Radio. I'm Frank Morrow, Executive Director Emeritus of the Fiscal Policy Institute, and I'm joined here in the WRPI studio today by Ron Deutsch, and usually on most days we're on by Brian McDonnell, AFSCME New York's Legislative and Political Director. And we'll be back again in August, probably on the first Tuesday. But you should listen to Capital District Progressive Radio every Tuesday morning on WRPI Troy. Now, stay tuned for Democracy Now!